From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last month, the House of Representatives approved the Broadcast Decency Enforcement Act of 2004. It raises the fine per violation from $27,500 to $500,000. This means that the FCC will have the power to levy multiple fines in the multi-millions for indiscretions on nationally syndicated shows. On Wednesday, broadcasters from around the country gathered with regulators, parents groups, and media watchdogs to mull over the issues. Oddly, the National Association of Broadcasters Summit on Responsible Programming, which was filled with representatives from big media, was closed to the press. But Broadcasting and Cable Magazine's Bill McConnell was lurking nearby, and he suspects that this time the broadcast chiefs were not flagellating themselves at nearly the rate they were in the congressional hearings over Janet Jackson's Super Bowl breast.
They were, you know, trying to say more, okay, we hear you. Here's our point of view. We don't think that the situation is as bad as you say it is, but we know you have some concerns that are reasonable, and we think there are a few things we can do to make it better.
A few things.
I think eventually the broadcasters will come up with something a little bit stronger than they have now, possibly reviving some form of the old code of conduct, or maybe something a little bit less strict that would strongly encourage broadcasters to set up a block of time for family viewing that isn't going to have raunchy or racy programming. But I think it's going to take a while. Yesterday, Eddie Fritz, the president of the National Association of Broadcasters, said, hey, you know, we're not going to have something in 30 days or 60 days. It's going to be a long-term project. By the sound of that, you can be guaranteed that nothing's going to happen immediately.
Or will it? While media heavies hem and haw over how to combat excessive indecency and excessive fines in the future, how are radio hosts and shock jocks reacting to the crackdown? Jesse Walker is the author of Rebels on the Air, An Alternative History of Radio in America, and the managing editor of Reason Magazine. In the last issue, he quotes the FCC's descriptions of a Scooby-Doo sketch performed by recently fired shock jock Bubba the Love Sponge. The FCC renders it in perfect bureaucratese.
The first skit begins when Shaggy tells Scooby-Doo that he needs crack cocaine but has no money to buy it. Scooby-Doo responds that Shaggy could, and then we bleep out a couple of words here, to pay for the drugs. In the next skit, Fat Albert, a.k.a. Fat Diddy Daddy, gets killed in a drive-by shooting after bragging that Jennifer Lopez had been bleeping Diddy Daddy's bleep the previous night, and then ends with, this segment contains sufficiently graphic and explicit references to sexual and excretory organs and activities to satisfy the first criterion of our contextual analysis.
So, in January, for this and a few other programs, the FCC charged Bubba the Love Sponge with the highest fine ever levied by the commission. What has been the result of this fine throughout the country?
One interesting thing about this fine is that it came a few days before the infamous Janet Jackson incident. And in that, of course, got everybody upset and Congress started talking and the FCC started making more audible noises. And companies like Clear Channel and Infinity that own all these radio stations started falling all over themselves to claim that they'd never realized that such stuff was going on over the airwaves and to fire people like Bubba the Love Sponge. When people aren't being fired, they've been dropped from stations. Howard Stern was famously dropped from several Clear Channel stations, although he's still being carried on, in particular, Infinity across the country.
Apart from fining stations, there has been talk of actually fining the performers themselves so that if you have a morning zoo in, you know, I don't know, Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and you get very, very vulgar, it's not management who's going to pay the fine, but you.
I've heard about that. I'm not sure it's going to pass. I think that it's an interesting way around the dilemma that certain conservative members of Congress might face where they don't want to make things difficult for media companies that perhaps donate to their campaigns, and yet they want to punish this kind of broadcasting. On the other hand, I mean, it's absurd to expect a human being to cough up the kinds of fines that they're now levying on stations. I think that a lot of them would end up being uncollectible.
Underlying this whole question is the fundamental hypocrisy of having shock jocks on the air to be outrageous in order to generate ratings, while there is this sort of undefinable threshold that they cannot cross where they become subject to gigantic fines. What do you suppose the calculus is in 2004 for these guys, they're mostly guys, in performing day to day?
Until Bubba the Love Sponge was fired and his website was taken down, it was proudly having a banner across the top, listen to the stuff the FCC doesn't want you to hear, or words to that effect. And there's always been like this sort of outlaw image to them. I think they imagine their ideal listener as sort of slapping himself on the head and saying, you can't say that on the radio, go get them. But in fact, the reason why they were able to get away with so much from the point of view of the FCC is that over the last 10 years, number one, there's been much less enforcement, and number two, where there has been enforcement, I mean, there would always be a new record fine against Infinity Broadcasting for something Howard Stern said. The shows were so profitable that it was, as Michael Copps, the FCC commissioner, likes to complain, considered a cost of doing business. What's changed in terms of the calculus is the fact that the FCC is now much more serious about cracking down on indecency, and then when Congress gets in the act, people really get worried, and the calculus has radically changed. And I think that the smart ones are maybe starting to think about what new shtick might I be able to do until there's yet another change in the air. You know, can I go and become like a DJ or a right-wing talk radio host or one of the other templates for a career as a radio broadcaster?
Are you getting a sense of deja vu through all of this? I mean, is this like Lenny Bruce all over again?
There used to be complaints that people would say that, you know, Lenny Bruce died so that this could happen. On the other hand, nobody's being persecuted the way Lenny Bruce was being personally persecuted. But that same sort of fear of words and that fear that there's certain topics that simply should not be discussed, even to a paying nightclub audience or to a voluntary radio listening audience, that's coming back. It's like a pendulum. It comes back every few years. The good news for those of us who are civil libertarians is that sooner or later the pendulum is probably going to swing back the other way, but you can't always count on that. And I think it's important to stand up for the rights of free speech in the First Amendment, even when it's someone who's not nearly as interesting or funny as Lenny Bruce was.
All right, Jesse. Thanks very much.
All right, thanks.
Jesse Walker is managing editor of Reason Magazine.
While the industry ponders its image problem, a few legislators have spied an opening to put media consolidation back on the table. The Broadcast Decency Enforcement Act, now awaiting action in the Senate, has two amendments attached to it. One, sponsored by North Dakota Democrat Byron Dorgan, puts a one-year hold on the rules passed late last year that would allow big media companies to get even bigger.
I think that there's evidence that the larger ownership groups have had more complaints filed against them. And one would expect that the farther you get away from what is called localism, more likely it is that someone far away is going to make a decision about what is broadcast in your area that may very well conflict with what you think represent good standards.
So there are more complaints against the big companies, but maybe that's because they own more stations. Has it really been shown that locally owned and operated media maintain a higher standard of decency or a more responsive one than the big companies?
The amendment that I offered that passed the Commerce Committee recently simply asks for a study. What I ask for is that we freeze or delay, rather, the FCC ownership rules from going into effect while this study occurs. It does seem to me that the larger the concentration of ownership in broadcast properties, the more likely it is that what is heard and seen in your local area has nothing to do with local standards or what people locally think. In fact, we had testimony before the Commerce Committee of a television station owner in a southern state saying, you know, the network was pushing a program that I felt was disgusting and I didn't want to show it in my area, but I didn't have any choice. They forced me to show it with the threat of substantial penalties. That's the kind of thing that I think we ought to resolve, because I think the use of the airways free of charge for radio and television broadcasters also requires responsibility, and part of that responsibility is to serve local interests and to preserve a sense of localism.
Now, a majority of the Congress seems to be in harmony on the issue of indecency and the need to do something about it, but the issue of broadcast ownership caps is quite controversial. And one lawmaker remarked that tinkering with the caps could be the, quote, poison pill that kills the whole decency bill.
Adding this amendment to the bill that deals with indecency is not something that is going to kill this bill. In fact, we've already voted in the U.S. Senate on the ownership cap, as you know, and Senator Trent Lott and I offered the amendment, and the Senate has expressed itself on that. We don't believe the FCC rules, which will allow much more concentrated ownership in the media properties, is an appropriate rule, and the Senate's already expressed itself on that.
But what about the House?
Well, you know, we legislate in the Senate. We can't control the U.S. House of Representatives.
Broadcasters are meeting in Washington to chat about these issues. And from your perspective, would the system be hurt or helped by broadcasters attempting to self-censor and err on the side of conservatism in order to avoid further regulation or crippling fines?
I think broadcasters have always had a responsibility to think through what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. You know, we used to have, for example, speaking of television, a family viewing hour when certain things during a time when children might be watching television would be inappropriate. That's not new, and it's not radical, and it's not unique. I would hope that we will see from broadcasters themselves some sense of concern about this and see them taking some action on their own.
You have a great deal of interest in media consolidation anyway because of the incident in Minot, North Dakota, the lack of response from the local radio stations there that were automated, and so the public could not respond in time to an emergency, a chemical spill.
Well, that is correct. And, you know, an explosion of some train cars loaded with anhydrous ammonia at 2 a.m. It covered a major part of a city of 50,000 people with a deadly gas. One was killed. Many were injured. Hundreds went to the hospital. I mean, and they, you know, they tried to sound an emergency alarm and couldn't get anyone at the radio station to pick up. And why? Because they're running homogenized music through a board from, you know, 1,000 miles away. In my judgment, local control and localism in broadcast property is something that's very important to the community. And we've gotten far away from that. And I would like the FCC not to be able to move us farther away even still with the new regulations, and that's why I've been fighting them so hard.
And so if the issue of health and safety hasn't pulled it back, perhaps the issue of indecency will.
Well, the issue of indecency is an issue that, you know, has a tipping point on its own, and anytime I have the opportunity to offer the amendment dealing with the concentration of ownership, I'm going to do that along with Senator Lott. That's why we put it on this bill.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot.
Senator Byron Dorgan is a Democrat from North Dakota.
Coming up, a TV ratings war, a radio air war, and a farewell to America's favorite Brit, who was also Britain's favorite Yank.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last month, this headline in the Dallas Morning News, Fox News Channel continues to crush CNN. So, that's been conventional wisdom in the cable news biz for at least 2 years, and a quick search of On the Media's archives shows us parroting that same seemingly indisputable fact that Fox News was beating CNN in the ratings game. But Steve Rendell of the liberal media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting does dispute it in an article titled The Ratings Mirage, Why Fox Has Higher Ratings When CNN Has More Viewers. Steve, welcome to the show.
It's great to be on, Brooke.
So you say that Fox is not actually beating CNN in the ratings, or actually, to be more precise, you say that on any given day, more people tune in to CNN than to Fox News. So what's the difference then between actual viewership and ratings?
Actually, the number that's usually reported in the media is a number that Nielsen Media Research releases for free. That number is the average number of viewers that are tuning in to a show or a station at any typical moment. That number gives extra weight to heavy viewers, viewers who tune into a station and linger there for a long period of time. For instance, if you tune into Fox in the evening, first you tune into Special Report with Brit Hume, then it goes through that into Shepard Smith's show and into the O'Reilly Factor, you are counted every minute. You can show up in the ratings as several viewers. But there's another number called the CUME, which is not published by Nielsen Media Research. They only release it to their paying clients. And it counts the total number of viewers who tune into a station or a show on a given day for 6 minutes or more. And it counts all viewers. And CNN has a higher CUME than Fox.
So obviously this speaks to the different way that those two channels are used.
One of the ad buyers I talked to told me that CNN is like news radio. People tune in for a short amount of time to get the news and the headlines. But they treat Fox like talk radio, where they tune in for longer periods of time to hear the personality-driven and opinion programming that's available there. Now, this could change at any time, but as it stands now, on any given day, CNN has about 20% more individual viewers than Fox does.
Now, you wrote in your piece that reporters who use the Nielsen numbers ought to explain that the data are not entirely reliable measures of popularity and that really the numbers serve no purpose for journalists or the public.
Well, yes, they're not sort of a democratic tally of who's more popular. They're collected by the Nielsen Media Research Center to provide very complex data to advertisers. This gets back to that question of heavy viewers and light viewers. Advertisers want viewers to hang around long enough to see their ad several times, but they're not interested in reaching the same viewer over and over again throughout the day. They'd like to reach more viewers. By the same token, advertisers don't want to advertise on stations where the viewers tune in for so short a time that they don't see very many ads. So it's a trade-off. One vice president of CNN that I quote in the piece says, "We'd like to have Fox's average. Fox would like to have our cume."
But I think it's safe to say that Fox would love to have CNN's ad revenue because they're still making substantially more.
CNN is still making more money than Fox. It's because they have those lighter viewers that are a more valuable demographic. Lighter viewers tend to be younger, busier, and more free spending. I expect that Fox will surpass CNN at some point in cume, but that will not necessarily mean that they'll bring in more ad revenue because Fox will still have a core viewership made up of those heavy viewers that are not as attractive to advertisers.
So let's assume then that you're right, that Fox is trailing CNN in actual numbers of viewers and that it's trailing CNN with regard to ad revenue. It nevertheless has the perception that it's trouncing CNN in the ratings. What's been the net effect of this perception?
Well, I think it's great public relations for Fox. In fact, there is one thing I quote in the piece where Brian Kilmeade, who's on Fox and Friends, very successful Fox morning show, responding to somebody who said that Fox leans to the right, he says, "Well, the people made us number one, so what does that say about the United States?"
What has Fox News had to say about your findings? Have you heard from anybody?
Well, I haven't heard any actual official response. I did get an email from a Fox VP who was very snarky, very sarcastic. It said, "Great piece. Sorry, your data's all old. We're ahead of CNN now in cume." And I quickly wrote back to him. I said, "Well, if you are, I'd like to see the numbers. Those cume numbers, remember, are not published. They're only provided for paying clients like Fox. Send me the numbers. I'd be glad to do an update." I haven't heard from him.
Okay. Steve Rendell, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Steve Rendell is senior analyst for the liberal media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. We called Fox News spokesman Robert Zimmerman about FAIR's research. He says Nielsen ratings are regarded as the key measure. Nobody pays attention to the cume. Meanwhile, on Wednesday, a new media war was joined on talk radio.
Broadcasting from an underground bunker 3,500 feet below Dick Cheney's bunker, Air America Radio is on the air. I'm Al Franken, and welcome to the O'Franken Factor. Today is both an ending and a beginning. An end to the right-wing dominance of talk radio. The beginning of a battle for truth. A battle for justice. A battle, indeed, for America itself. Not to be grandiose.
In this battle, there are many foot soldiers, but only two real generals, and one of them is Franken, the driving force behind Air America, the liberal network that could. You can hear its lineup of personalities, among them Franken, Janine Garofalo, and Chuck D, currently on six stations, also satellite radio and the Internet. Franken's show starts at noon. There's a reason for that.
No, I'm not just observing the media. I am the new media.
Opposing General Rush Limbaugh.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the award-winning, thrill-packed, ever-exciting, increasingly popular, growing by leaps and bounds, Rush Limbaugh program. We come to you each day today as we are from the Limbaugh Institute for Advanced Conservative Studies.
his dominance cemented long ago, scores of other conservative hosts have ridden to success on his coattails, building a huge audience for his message on the AM band. So much so that there's no home for liberals on most talk radio, which is why Air America is buying or leasing its own stations. Franken says his real goal is to push Bush out of the White House. The Air America chiefs say it will take 3 years for the network to make a profit. Franken's contract lasts a year. Do you see yourself doing this for longer than a year?
I think I want to see how much I like it.
I think Al, and I don't want to speak for him because he's an amazing cat.
Mark Walsh is CEO of Progress Media, the parent company of Air America.
But I think Al's platform and the megaphone that this gives him for his viewpoints and his comedy, I hope it becomes addictive so that he wants to do this with us for as long as he will have us.
Franken's first show with co-host Catherine Lamfer, late of Minnesota Public Radio, featured a call-in from Al Gore, himself currently trying to launch a liberal cable channel. Guest Michael Moore gamely apologized for supporting Ralph Nader 4 years ago.
Michael, is there something you'd like to say to the vice president?
Michael?
Come
on. Al, you know, I just, you know, we're really sorry, Al.
For what, Michael?
After Air America's first broadcast day, there was a rush to judgment. Variety called it an awkward affair. The New York Times said the first day highlighted the difficulty in trying to match the fervor and ferocity of right-wing radio. The Washington Post called the O'Franken factor meandering and discursive, and worse still, almost NPR-like. I didn't hear that.
Now, we got to go in with our friend Ann Coulter. And
for those of you who are just joining us, we've locked her in our green room. That was about 2.5 hours ago.
Ann?
It's not funny.
Ann, come on. We wouldn't do it.
I've got a nail file. I'll rip up your leather couch. I'll do it. I swear.
Number one, coming out of the box, we're going to speak to the converted and the curious.
Rapper and Air America talk show host Chuck D says his role will be to bring in people from his background.
Quite often, the people from my class are locked out of the equation. Sometimes it could get to a point where the discussions are white Americans dealing with white American issues, and they happen to be at the two different extremes, but everybody else is on the outside looking in.
It's often been said that talk radio runs on the anger of the outsider. Air America was launched on the rage of liberals who feel that President Bush hijacked their country.
Our friends on the right say that we liberals are angry. Yeah. Yeah. We're angry. For a lot of us, it's because of 9/11. On that horrible day, our nation became as united as I have ever seen it. And the world was behind us. George W. Bush had an amazing opportunity to lead this country, this world, into a new American century in a spirit of mutual purpose and mutual sacrifice. And he blew it. He blew it.
But Limbaugh was angry first, and he does angry better.
The idea that there was unity, that the Democrats were united in purpose behind this president is the myth. They were worried this was an opportunity for Bush to display greatness. Remember that? And they're sitting around and they're saying, well, we were all unified. We had all this unity. We were at one with ourselves and at one with the world. And Bush has destroyed all of it. Well, that's just a crock.
Still, the liberals have deep reserves of untapped rage to direct against a legion of Limbaughs, if only they can stay mad.
J'accuse!
But what if Kerry wins? Richard Viguerie is a longtime master in the use of alternative media like direct mail and talk radio to promote the issues of the far right.
If Kerry is elected president this fall, then I think it's going to be very hard for Air America to sustain an audience out there.
But what about Rush now? Rush is doing as well as he ever has done, and both the White House and the Congress and arguably the Supreme Court are in the hands of Republicans.
Yes, Republicans, but not conservatives. Grassroots conservatives have never been in control of the government. Republicans have. And the Republican administration is a great disappointment these days to conservatives.
Oh. Apparently, Russia's ever-expanding reach is due to the fact that even now, the government is not conservative enough. Maybe never can be conservative enough. On the other hand, according to Viguerie, John Kerry's ascension to the White House should be sufficient to assuage the liberals.
I vociferously disagree.
Progress Media CEO Mark Walsh.
In fact, if John Kerry wins in 2004, I think our business is even better. Why? Because Tom DeLay ain't going away. Nino Scalia ain't going away. Dennis Hastert and Trent Lott and Bill Frist are not going away. In fact, when John Kerry wins, there'll be just as much pomposity and idiocy for us to skewer in the airwaves as there is today.
This goes out to my friend Rush.
I'm Rush the Magic Dragon, the right-wing drugstore cowboy, a hillbilly heroin addict, a ditto-head deadhead now boy. You know that my opinions were always kind of whack. Now you know the reason. I'm strung out on mountain smack. My drugs are red, white, and blue.
Maybe Walsh has a point. Right now, the stakes have never been higher, and conservative or liberal, everybody is mad as hell. The pressure is rising, and the ozone is filling with hot air. Looks like perfect weather for talk radio. Oh, let's not. Look, I loved Masterpiece Theater, and especially I loved Alistair Cook's courtly introductions to British lit transmuted into television. But as Cook himself observed, he was merely head waiter to those TV feasts, there to explain what's on the menu and how those dishes were composed. He was not the chef. But he was, in fact, a master chef. For an astonishing 58 years on BBC Radio, he dished out complex and savory servings of America to an eager and curious world. He died this week at the age of 95 after chronicling a nation in continuous evolution. His first, Letter from America, offered this description of a long line of customers for nylon stockings in post-war New York.
People get afraid they'll miss their assigned pair of stockings. So a woman queues up for one pair, and her husband, nonchalantly disguised, for another. Need I say there are also in these queues smooth-looking gents and crummy-looking youths with fake ration certificates who have no personal use for nylons and no wife or girlfriend to be a hero for. They're just doing the rounds of the queues by way of running their own modest black market.
Decade after decade, he sent missives filled with vivid description, historical context, and his own fascination with his adopted country. But in truth, though he was in America, he was not of America, and therein lies the loss for most of us. We never had the chance to see ourselves in his eyes. Usually he saw us at a distance, albeit a short one, but once he found himself a mere 10 feet from an American tragedy, the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, he captured the moment like a camera lens.
There was a head on the floor, streaming blood, and somebody put a Kennedy boater under it, and the blood trickled down like chocolate sauce on an ice cake. There were flashlights by now, and the button eyes of Ethel Kennedy turned to cinders. She was slapping a young man, and he was saying, "Listen, lady, I'm hurt too." And down on the greasy floor was a huddle of clothes, and staring out of it, the face of Bobby Kennedy, like the stone face of a child lying on a cathedral tomb.
Then he viewed the emotional fallout with the same sharp focus and shook his head.
5 days later, I still cannot rise to the general lamentations about a sick society. I, for one, do not feel like an accessory to a crime, and I reject almost as a frivolous obscenity the sophistry of collective guilt, the idea that I or the American people killed John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Martin Luther King and Robert Francis Kennedy. I said as much as this to a younger friend, and he replied, "Yes, but, and I too, I don't feel implicated in the murder of John or Bobby Kennedy. But when Martin Luther King is killed, the only people who know that you and I are not like the killer are you and I." It's a tremendous sentence and exposes, I think, the present danger to America. The more people talk about collective guilt, the more they will feel it. And after 300 years of subjection and prejudice, any poor Negro or desperate outcast is likely to act as if it were true that the American people, and not their derelicts, are the villains.
Alistair Cook's staunchly conservative principles were sometimes out of step with his adopted nation and with his native Britain. But even when he departed from the views of modern America, even when he couldn't quite fathom them, his was a bracing perspective, the product of a first-class mind. As Prime Minister Tony Blair observed this week, millions found wisdom and comfort in Cook's letters from America. But toward the end, perhaps no one needed them as much as he himself did. Friends say they literally kept him alive. And indeed, he died just a few weeks after resigning in late February.
Just recently, a British journalist who seemed to have a gift for making mischief where he couldn't find it asked me if anybody in the BBC had ever asked me to retire, and was I going to do so anyway? I said the answer was no. And no. I've noticed if you retire, you keel over. The day of retirement from this assignment, which was given to me 50 years ago by the BBC official who bore the grand title of Director of the Spoken Word, the day of retirement is up to the Lord of us all, the great timekeeper in the sky, the true Director of the Spoken Word.
A sampling of his letters from America can be found at the BBC website. It's a chance to hear a little more of what we've missed, the real masterpieces of the person known to most of us as merely a host in an armchair, the late, great Alistair Cook.
Coming up, staged stings of presumed pedophiles, plus men who hate shirts and the programs that love them.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of non-profit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with a few of your letters. Most of them concerned Brooke's interview with Morning Edition host Bob Edwards, who will be leaving that post for a job as NPR senior correspondent. Kate Donnelly of Chicago writes, "It was so sad to listen to Bob Edwards grasp at straws to understand his pink slip. The situation smacks of bad and tactless management. Thanks to OTM for a sensitive and revealing interview."
But that conversation left many listeners deeply unsatisfied. Hearing Mr. Edwards say repeatedly that he had no idea why he'd been canned by NPR is not informative. It simply points out a gaping, unfilled hole in your story, writes Joshua Tanzer of Hoboken, New Jersey. Did that not make you want to find out why for yourselves? Why not interrogate the people who made the decision and get the answer rather than tell us repeatedly that you don't know?
Most wrote in to say they were stunned by Bob Edwards' reassignment. Marty Weston writes, "I love his minimalist morning chatter. It makes getting up in the mornings easy, even when the day's events are troubling, the world is a mess, and the temptation is to pull the covers over my head." And Leanne Gilbertson adds, "I think NPR has done a great disservice not only to Bob Edwards, but to its listeners."
But there were a few dissenters, like Heidi J. Levin of Chicago. She writes, "In listening to the interview, I was struck by Bob Edwards' more outgoing and assertive personality versus what one normally hears in the morning. While I like Bob Edwards' approach now, as it focuses on those reporting on the news, who are there and have something meaningful to say, I wonder if Bob were just a little more like he was on your interview, whether he would be leaving."
This postscript now to our stories 2 weeks ago about VNRs, video news releases packaged by public relations firms to look like actual news and distributed by various major news feeders, including CNN. In the uproar over the Department of Health and Human Services VNR, which ran as an apparent news story on stations around the country, CNN has changed its VNR policy to segregate and strictly label PR material from its other news feeds. Thanks for your letters. Keep sending them along to us at onthemedia@wnyc.org, and We'll ask one more time. Don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Consider the sting. Agents go on the internet, posing as young girls and boys, and engage in online chats with adults. The talk turns to sex, sometimes at the initiation of the fake teen, sometimes at the initiation of the targeted predator at the other end. Arrangements are made for them to meet. The target drives to a remote location for a sexual encounter with a child, only to discover the trap. It's a standard law enforcement technique, but what if the agents aren't cops, but in fact vigilantes running the sting in cooperation with the local TV station? The unsuspecting men show up at a rented house only to be met with lights, microphones, and cameras. Their startled mugs are then broadcast on the evening news. That's precisely what's been happening recently in several cities around the country. News crews have been teaming up with pervertedjustice.com, a group that for the past 2 years has been setting up stings and posting pictures, phone numbers, and addresses of the men they snare on the web. KCTV in Kansas City hired the group to help snare 16 internet predators for its February Sweeps Week special.
These men just drove to a house they've never seen to meet a person they don't know for a reason that most people would define as perverted.
I'm just here for
you. You're not here to have sex with a 14-year-old girl?
Well, no. Yes, he is. How do we know? Because we set it up.
Sam Zeff is executive producer of special projects at KCTV, and he joins me now. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
Let me ask you, understanding that you're not law enforcement and understanding that the men lured into this trap will in all probability have their lives ruined, what did you do to make absolutely certain that every I was dotted, every T crossed, that these were genuine predators and not casual chatters on a lark fooling around with no evil intent?
Well, I can tell you that none of the men who came to our door were registered sex offenders, none even had a criminal record. Now, what did we go through to make sure that we had that we properly identified every man, to make sure that we didn't put the wrong man with the wrong chat or the wrong face or the wrong name on television? The reporting on that was extensive, from checking databases to actually taking these men's photographs out to check with neighbors to say, is this the man that you know as blank. It took weeks, hundreds of man hours to do. And by the time we put the story on television, we had uncovered that one of the men who came to our door was a recruiter for the United States Navy, a man, Bob, a man who every day spent his time in high schools and malls meeting with kids the same age as the person he thought he was going to meet to have sex. We uncovered a man who spent his evenings as a middle school and high school referee of volleyball. We uncovered a former federal police officer.
Has any of them been charged with a crime?
No. Not to our knowledge so far. Now, we know Navy NCIS is investigating our recruiter. That has so far not resulted in any charges, but that investigation is continuing.
At least one of the men stung by your investigation thinks that he was, in fact, lured into a situation that he would not otherwise have been in. All of the sexual conversation was very much led by the person who he thought was a 14-year-old girl. Everything that he said in response was qualified by the LOL code, which means laugh out loud, which is ha-ha-ha, just kidding. And though they discussed him showing up with condoms and liquor, he showed up without a condom or any liquor. He further claims that he never even would have gone there had he not gotten a phone call promising sex from a woman he was certain was middle-aged. It's quite clear that this never would have held up in court in a law enforcement case against a suspected pedophile. Are the journalistic standards different?
I think they absolutely are. As a journalist, I have the ethical obligation to make sure that the person I'm stinging, that I'm sure of his intent, and then I have to give him a reasonable chance to respond. And I would say, Bob, that talking about drinking and getting high and bringing prophylactics over to a 14-year-old's house is on its face irresponsible. The only information this man had was what he gained through the chat. And I would say that any reasonable and responsible adult, if he is in a chat room and all of a sudden that chat turns sexual, he has got to disengage that chat immediately. He didn't do it. He got in his car. He drove to this remote location. I'm absolutely convinced of what his intentions were.
What about the larger issue of simply trawling for perverts? Is that the job of a news organization?
Is it a huge problem? Yes. Is it our responsibility as journalists to show that problem and to expose it? It's absolutely our job. Local law enforcement is behind the curve. I mean, we have the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Missouri in our piece saying as much. We've heard from police officers in this area, prosecutors, people who we deal with all the time, tell us, you know what, your story was right on. And I've heard and read in various publications that law enforcement in other communities where this particular story has been done are upset. I can tell you that here in Kansas City, only the FBI so far has had anything negative to say about our story.
God, this is a tough one. Let me tell you why it's so tough for me. You know, I'm certainly delighted that internet predators are being outed. I'm queasy journalistically, but can't even tell you why. I mean, I cannot articulate for you what it is about this that makes me nervous.
I think that your journalistic, if I may, instincts are right on, and they were exactly the feelings I had before we went down this road. But when you see the men, when you read the chats, when you understand that law enforcement, at least here in Kansas City, doesn't seem to have the ability to track these people down, and when you weigh the fact that you've got these 16 men that you've identified, that you've shown on television, and when you weigh that against the possibility of 16 young lives being ruined, I don't see how you can't move forward with this investigation and not feel good about its broadcast.
Well, Sam, thank you very much.
Bob, it's my pleasure.
Sam Zeff is executive producer for Special Projects at KCTV in Kansas City.
It's true that KCTV earned huge ratings for their pedophile sting series, and maybe it was, as Sam Zeff says, because they were performing a much-needed service in naming and shaming potential internet predators. Or maybe it was that people just really enjoy the humiliating spectacle of a bust caught on tape.
North Carolina, 1994. Officers find themselves against an enraged man with a shotgun. It's a delicate matter, but one the police are equipped to handle.
The show is called World's Wildest Police Videos. The image is a shotgun-wielding man, shirtless on his porch, raving at police. He has gotten himself stinking blotto. He has done violence in his household. Now he is making terrorist threats and a total jackass of himself for all his neighbors and a few million others to see. Renee Less can scarcely believe her good fortune.
He's just this big, fat guy on his porch raving with an enormous gun, and they're all shirtless. None of them are wearing shirts.
She is lucky because in addition to having no shirts, the shotgun-wielding porch stander honors of this nation also have no shame. This man signed a release permitting World's Wildest Police Videos to broadcast his image, and the owner of most every other unobscured face you see on these gritty police reality shows has done the same thing. Lesk is in charge of obtaining these releases. She is awash in 8x11 forms, ready to be stuffed into dozens and dozens of thick vinyl binders.
There's an alternate paper universe that agrees with the visual universe that you look at every day.
But why? Why let some TV producer trade in your personal humiliation? Fred Heilbrunn, a permissions specialist who has obtained nearly 10,000 releases for such shows as True Stories of the Highway Patrol, offers a number of explanations, from malignant macho to civic mindedness to, every so often, cash money. But it is still hard for him to believe how easy it is. Once, he says, he was with a camera crew at a heroin bust, and one of the suspects bolted directly toward them.
The cameraman, who is built like a halfback, steps out. The suspect falls backward into a wall, and the cameraman sticks the camera in this fella's face. And then the cameraman follows it up by saying, "Don't move or I'll shoot you." And the fella threw his hands up in the air and complied like the cameraman had an MP5 pointed at the guy's head. It was just amazing.
Did you approach him to sign a release?
Oh, yeah. And he signed.
To Rene Lesk, the stop or I'll shoot gambit suggests another possibility for suspects' willingness to sign on the dotted line, the confusion over who is a cop and who isn't, and maybe the hope that cooperation with the camera crew will yield softer treatment from the police down the line. Fred Heilbrunn says cultivating that confusion is unethical, and often enough, he says, an opposite force may be at work.
I found out that when the police come through your door, you know, knock it off its hinges, come barreling through, throw you into the wall, handcuff you, and then somebody walks up and says, "Hi, my name's Fred. Has anybody told you what the cameras are about?" The people relaxed.
Bad cop, good producer.
Yeah. You know, I have to admit, I learned some of my techniques from watching the police work.
One thing that all release getters quickly learn is that the culture of reality television, and the culture in general, work in their favor. In this society, appearing on television is deemed an achievement in its own right, and neither the subjects nor the audience seem to be all that concerned about how that is achieved. You know, "Hey, Tony, I saw you on TV. Was that your shotgun? What happened to your shirt?"
I think my favorite was a fella who, to pay off a debt to a dealer, offered his barn to be set up as a meth lab. The way the police found out about him was his electric bill, which should have been perhaps $150 a month, was something like $10,000 a month, and he wasn't paying it.
As police raided the barn, the guy quickly grabbed a guitar and started singing.
When I told him what I wanted, he said, "Will you show me singing?" And I said, "If you'd like." And he signed the release.
No matter that he faced 20 years in prison.
He wanted to be sure that he was going to have at least 10 seconds of himself singing on a national television show, so we gave that to him.
How was the song?
It was terrible. Just terrible. I think, if I recall, he was doing like Puff the Magic Dragon, and just, Joe, it was just awful.
There's yet another category, the chastened criminal who wants to steer others away from foolish choices. Lesk's biggest coup was getting a release from a woman arrested for DWI who was taped for an hour making sexual advances on the arresting officer.
"I can't help it, but I just know you're good looking.
I appreciate
that.
Okay.
You know, beautiful. Sign
right there for me, okay?
I sign right there.
Thank you, ma'am."
That was, as they say, this lady's rock bottom, and she was persuaded that making herself a laughingstock on television was an appropriate way to begin her new life of sobriety. But of all the explanations for why Lesk's vinyl binders are so full, maybe the best is the most obvious.
Criminals are stupid.
And the best illustration is a piece of tape aired on her show for which no release was necessary because the suspect's face was not visible.
"We saw a guy walk into a convenience store with a paper bag over his head. No holes. You know, he was obviously having some trouble seeing. And he tried to rob it. And it was so, he seemed so ineffectual because of the paper bag and the no holes, that the clerk didn't really understand that he was seriously trying to rob him and he didn't have a weapon. So the clerk just said, I'm sorry, I don't understand you. And the guy with the bag on his head just walked away. Criminals are stupid. They're criminals because they're stupid. Their stupidity puts them in jail. Their stupidity keeps them in jail. When they get out of jail, their stupidity puts them back in jail. Criminals are stupid.
So what you're suggesting is, if I can read between the lines here, you're suggesting, and don't let me, please, put words in your mouth, that criminals are stupid.
That's what I'm saying.
As for the zeitgeist image of the shirtless ruffian on his porch raving, Lesk says, be not misled. There are no more of these people nowadays, she believes, than there ever were.
I think there are just more cameras. I got to tell you, I think the shirtless guy was raving at the police for our grandparents and our great-grandparents. But now there are cameras to capture it. They look for opportunities to capture it. Now we all see it, and the guy without the shirt doesn't mind. He wants his rants to be heard. He's perfectly happy with that development.
Thank you. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Rob Christensen, our engineer. We had help from Derek John. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.